Good morning. This is Ed Reedy from the Talking Information Center with the Sunday, August 23rd reading of the New York Times. U.S. economy could feel the sting from trade war with Canada. A tit-for-tat trade fight between the two allies could create new headaches for consumers and businesses already stung by high prices. By Tony Rome. Since President Trump has returned to office, the United States and Canada have repeatedly come close to an all-out trade war, only for Mr. Trump to dial back some of his harshest attacks against one of America's closest allies. But that period of relative calm came to an end on Saturday as new 50% tariffs from Washington took effect, drawing a pointed threat from Canada to respond in kind. The resulting clash left the two American neighbors barreling toward a dangerous tit-for-tat escalation, one that may yet inflict real harm on the U.S. economy. For Mr. Trump, the return to trade brinksmanship reaffirmed a time-old truth. His tariffs are taxes on imports, meaning some of the cost of his latest duties may ultimately fall hardest on U.S. importers, stung by years of persistently high prices. Although Mr. Trump's tariffs only cover a small subset of Canadian goods, the consequences could quickly spiral. If Canada retaliates and Mr. Trump does the same, the result could be a series of new shocks for the U.S. economy at a time when it is already weathering plenty. The bigger deal is uncertainty, said Scott Lincecum, the Vice President of General Economics at the Cato Institute. Mr. Lincecum said that volatility had pervaded Mr. Trump's entire second term, as his ever-shifting tariffs raised and lowered, sometimes by the stroke of a pen, roil Wall Street, anger the courts, infuriate U.S. allies, and help to drive up the price of consumer goods domestically. With Canada, though, Mr. Lincecum said the new clash could weigh heavily on businesses that transact across the U.S.-Canadian border. The retaliatory tariff increases could affect prices and consequently translate to slightly less investment, slightly less economic activity, while the confusing trade climate persists. In the end, Mr. Trump could still avert catastrophe and strike a deal with Canada as soon as this weekend, but by Saturday morning that appeared unlikely. Jameson Greer, the U.S. trade representative, told Fox News that there were no new talks planned with his Canadian counterparts, adding that the administration was moving forward with its tariffs. In response, Canada showed no sign that it planned to back down. Hours later, Mark Carney, the country's prime minister, threatened to unveil its own tariff measures against the United States shortly after Labor Day, targeting sectors including agriculture, steel, and electronics. At one point, Mr. Carney even said his country was at war. Mr. Trump's new duties, set at 50%, apply to about $20 billion in Canadian exports to the United States, according to administration officials. The list of covered goods numbers into the hundreds and includes Canadian-made hockey sticks, furniture, and dairy products, which could become too expensive for U.S. consumers to import. Overall, though, the tariffs apply to a small fraction of trade between the two nations, muting the impact, at least for now. In an early analysis, John Rico, Deputy Director of Policy Analysis at the Yale Budget Lab, a nonpartisan think tank, said the new tariffs would raise the average tariff rate on Canadian imports to about 7.6% from roughly 5.3%. The United States already had in place steep tariffs on other critical Canadian imports, including its lumber, steel, and cars. But unlike Mr. Trump's past tariffs, the duties he imposed Saturday come with no special exemption for goods that are otherwise covered under a trade agreement the United States brokered with Canada and Mexico, a pact that the president separately has said he hopes to revise or kill. Joe Brusilius, the chief economist at the audit and consulting firm RSM US, said he still believed a deal was possible, but he added that the risk of escalation were also real and could be costly. For one thing, Mr. Brusilius said he expected that Canada might take aim where it hurts the most, perhaps including the U.S. auto industry. That could result in risks around the inflation outlook at a time when manufacturing continues to lag. A retaliatory cycle could complicate the nation's existing battle with inflation, which remains well above the 2% target that the Federal Reserve aims for, despite Mr. Trump's arguments to the contrary. In fact, rising prices prompted the president just this week to relax his tariffs on beef imports, a tacit acknowledgement that his trade policies had hit Americans' wallets. Increasingly, those economic anxieties have also spilled into financial markets. Concerns about America's mounting debt load, which hit $40 trillion this week, helped send yields on government bonds soaring. The war with Iran has also posed economic challenges, crimping growth globally while causing fuel costs to rise. Some Democrats in Congress cited additional risks as they attacked the president in recent days, arguing that his threats against Canada could create real economic blowback for the United States. Shortly after the tariffs went into effect, Senator Peter Welch, Democrat of Vermont, described the duties as a slap in the face to farmers and others in the state that do business across the border. Cross-border business relationships, built over decades, are in the lurch, he said. Uncertainty about a long-term trade deal with our closest ally has grown, and long-term trade negotiations seem to now be on ice. But there was still a sense among some on Washington and Wall Street that the worst with Canada might still be avoided, and that the drama playing out in public reflected the now usual course of business with Mr. Trump. We've all been conditioned to the sequencing of these negotiations, Mr. Brusilius said. Carney stands up to Trump in trade war despite the risks. Canada's prime minister walked away from what he thought was a bad trade deal with the United States. Many Canadians are behind him, but it will be costly. By Martina Stevens-Grenief. On Friday night, Prime Minister Mark Carney of Canada did something that few other world leaders before him have dared to do. After days of intense trade negotiations with the United States, with less than an hour to go on a midnight deadline for a new round of tariffs from the Trump administration, Mr. Carney instructed his negotiators to walk away. Then he announced that once 50% tariffs came into effect on $20 billion worth of Canadian goods, he would order a retaliatory tariff on the United States, dollar for dollar. Then on Saturday, in a lengthy televised address to Canadians, Mr. Carney brought fighting words to Canada's act of defiance. Last spring, I warned that America is trying to break us so that they can own us, and I promised that will never, ever happen. We are keeping that promise, Mr. Carney said somberly before reporters in Ottawa. Canada is becoming stronger and less dependent on America. We are already giving ourselves more than they can take away, and we are just getting started, he added. By walking away, Mr. Carney chose a road that no major U.S. ally has taken. With his country's economy on the line, he stood up to President Trump and refused to accept the administration's offer of a new trade relationship with tariffs permanently baked in. Britain, the European Union, and other major U.S. trading partners have agreed to smaller deals that have been volatile and often left them worse off. The collapse of the talks came after Mr. Trump declared on Tuesday that the deal was practically done. Mr. Carney never echoed that. Over the week, as negotiators spent long hours in Washington, huddled in the office of the U.S. Trade Representative, Mr. Carney appeared optimistic, but insisted that there was still work to be done. Until there wasn't. Each side now claims that the other introduced new or unreasonable demands at the last minute, the kind of finger-pointing that is common when trade talks fall apart. On Saturday, Mr. Carney mentioned in some detail a number of what he described as last-minute curveballs presented by the United States as talks were supposedly near the finish line. Those included, he said, a demand that Canada comply with U.S. dictates on tariffs on its trade with other countries. We are the partners of choice for countries around the world, and the Americans wanted to restrict that. Unacceptable, he said. Make no mistake, Mr. Carney has a lot to lose. Canada, which is closely integrated with the United States and relies on it for defense, is heavily dependent on trade with its superpower neighbor. Mr. Carney acknowledged on Saturday the cost of his choice for many Canadians and said his government would do whatever it takes to support businesses and workers impacted by the U.S. tariff, as well as those impacted by the retaliatory tariffs Canada will take out against U.S. goods on September 8th. It will also be costly for U.S. residents who have been paying for Mr. Trump's tariff policies through higher prices that have also been driven by the war in Iran and spiraling oil costs. But Mr. Carney appeared resolved to shoulder the costs of his decision, and he has risked Mr. Trump's ire before. In a speech in Davos, Switzerland in January, he described a new era in which the United States was no longer a guarantor of stability and where middle powers like Canada have to unite to survive. The speech and its enthusiastic global reception angered Mr. Trump. Mr. Trump has also been riled by Mr. Carney's outreach to China, which led to a narrow but significant trade agreement this year. By Canadian provinces' persistence on banning the sale of U.S. liquor, and by the Carney government's retaliatory measures against the United States for its broad, devastating tariffs on core Canadian industries. Since he rose to lead Canada last year, Mr. Carney has put in motion a plan to help his country survive. Mr. Trump's presidency and, in the long run, thrive apart from the United States. One of his favorite lines is that nostalgia is not a policy, and he has told everyone who will listen that there's no going back to the old relationship with the United States, a close and familial, if lopsided, bond. Instead, Mr. Carney has been traveling to secure new partnerships in Asia and Europe, a generational shift away from economic dependence on the United States, although that is unlikely to bear fruit fast enough to cushion the blow of the breakdown of the two countries' relationship. It's likely that Mr. Trump will not take kindly to Mr. Carney's trade decision. Just before beginning his second term, Mr. Trump said he was willing to inflict economic pain on Canada to get what he wanted. He has repeatedly expressed a desire to make Canada the 51st state, describing it as little more than a vassal that lives because of the United States. But Mr. Carney's vision for Canada, with a surprising assist from Mr. Trump's needling, has ignited a wave of patriotism. Going into the trade talks, more than half of Canadians, many more than those who voted for Mr. Carney, said they wanted him to give nothing away. Several premiers of different political stripes expressed their support for Mr. Carney after his decision. Doug Ford, a conservative who leads Ontario, cheered him on. David Eby, the progressive premier of British Columbia, said, "We didn't ask for this, but we'll keep fighting for as long as it takes." Not everyone is enthusiastic. Danielle Smith, the conservative premier of Alberta, who has good relations with the MAGA movement, was more circumspect and urged Mr. Carney to return to the negotiating table. Canada's industry is aghast with the prolonged turbulence and uncertainty that Mr. Trump's trade war against Canada and Mr. Carney's refusal to submit are causing. But there's little doubt that Mr. Carney will also be cheered at home and abroad for doing what he thought was best for his country. We take this step confident that it is the best interest of Canada, he said, and that by rejecting a bad deal, standing up for Canada, and focusing on what we can control, we're building a Canada strong for us all. Harry and Meghan see their California dreams and riches fade away. Like so many others before them, Prince Harry and Meghan arrived in Hollywood with big plans. They're leaving with their star power fading. By Nicole Sperling and Sean Hubler. It began with such high hopes. The Duke and Duchess of Sussex landed in Hollywood in 2020, flush with a multimillion-dollar Netflix deal and a promise that the duo, scorned by the royal family, would make a slew of inspirational programming. 2 years later, Harry and Meghan, the Netflix six-part docuseries on the couple's departure from Britain, generated 23.4 million views in its initial release, immediately topping the company's charts as its most watched ever for the first 4 days of a documentary. In total, the program has garnered 70 million views since its debut. Nothing else Prince Harry and his wife Meghan ever made for the service, whether it was Live to Lead, seven-episode interview show with world leaders, or Polo, a docuseries about the sport, reached such heights. In 2025, the Netflix deal was not renewed. A similarly lofty agreement at Spotify also fell short of expectations. And as Americans asked this week why the couple was leaving their West Coast ideal, Hollywood observers pointed to one of the most enduring themes in the history of Southern California, show business aspirations that failed. There's always been this aura here, this magical thinking, said Leo Brody, a Los Angeles cultural historian and the author of The Frenzy of Renown, Fame and Its History. Everybody thinks I'm beautiful or I'm handsome. Everybody thinks if those people can make it in Hollywood, so can I. But most people don't make it, he said, and throughout history, even otherwise wealthy and powerful people have mistakenly imagined that success in other fields would automatically translate to show business glory. If there was an easy path to success in show business, Mr. Browdy said, there would be a lot fewer flops in Hollywood. The Duke and Duchess made waves this week on both sides of the Atlantic after people familiar with the decision confirmed that they were returning to England. 6 years ago, the couple, after clashing with the royal family, had exiled themselves to California, where the Duchess had grown up and once had an acting career in Los Angeles. Settling into a sprawling estate in the wealthy enclave of Montecito, California, the couple raised two children, Archie 7 and Lilibet 5. But they now have enrolled their children in school in Britain and timed the move to coincide with the start of classes next month, according to sources who spoke to the New York Times. It's unclear whether they will launch new business ventures or where they will live in Britain. They were told to vacate their official residence on the grounds of Windsor Castle in 2023, the couple's press secretary said at the time. A representative for the couple on Friday framed their departure from California as a short-term move. On the heels of a wonderful trip with family and friends this summer, Harry and Meghan have decided to spend an extended period in the UK this autumn. The representative said in a statement they are excited to have their children spend more time in the country that's such an important part of their family's story. The royal couple's fortunes began contracting when Netflix did not renew their overall deal last year. In its place, the streaming giant established a much less generous pact, which still exists, whereby they would be paid only if they produced a show or a film Netflix was interested in airing. The streaming giant still pays for office space at Raleigh Studios in Hollywood for the couple's company, Archwell Productions. Separately, Netflix constructed a joint business deal with Megan for As Ever, her nascent lifestyle brand, which drafted off her television show With Love, Megan. An accompanying endeavor would sell products like $28 orange blossom honey and $14 apricot spread. Netflix manufactured those products through its consumer product group in a revenue-sharing deal. But the show didn't perform up to Netflix standards. The first season attracted 6.1 million views, second season earned 2.3 million views, and the Christmas special had 2.6 million views. Netflix decided to not greenlight any new seasons and ended the brand endeavor in March. Now all consumer goods are handled by Megan's own company. The $12 BlackBerry Jam is still available on the website. The duo's foray into products didn't go as planned either. In 2020, they signed a $20 million deal with Spotify, but they only produced one season of Archetypes, in which Megan hosted and interviewed guests such as Serena Williams and Paris Hilton. Harry never made anything, despite workshopping ideas with the company for a year. One idea, said one person close to the couple, was taste-testing hot chocolate around the country. It's unclear whether they were paid the full amount of the three-year deal, considering they only made one 12-episode season. A representative for the couple declined to comment. Spotify also declined to comment. In 2023, Jeremy Zimmer, then the head of the United Talent Agency, sat for an interview at the Cannes Lion Marketing Festival with Semaphore, a digital news site, just 1 week after the Spotify deal fizzled and defined the problem. Turns out Meghan Markle was not a great audio talent, or necessarily any kind of talent. And you know, just because you're famous doesn't make you great at something. Bill Simons, a Spotify executive and prominent podcaster, was never more blunt. He called the couple grifters, using an expletive in a 2023 podcast after the Spotify deal fell apart. Megan's most recent project, Cookie Queens, a documentary about the Girl Scouts and their cookie sale ambitions that the executive executive produced, was not a huge hit at the box office. Cat Video Fest 2026, a film that compiled the best cat videos on the internet, outgrossed hers. Yet according to Howard Cohn, the distributor of the movie, throughout his roadside attractions company, the movie will ultimately be a success. Released by only 446 screens, the film is nearing $1 million at the box office and will be available to rent through streaming on September 8th. With documentaries struggling in theaters, the movie is, in fact, the highest-grossing non-celebrity documentary to be released so far this year. Megan's appearance at both Sundance, where it initially debuted, and at screenings in Los Angeles and Ojai helped buoy those numbers, Mr. Cohen said in an interview. Megan will also appear in the Amazon Prime movie Close Personal Friends that is set to be released on the streaming service next spring. The film stars Brie Larson and Lily Collins and is set in Santa Barbara. Megan plays herself in a cameo. The Duchess is also in early talks to appear in the third season of the Netflix crime series The Gentlemen. Should the deal come to fruition, Megan would film the role in Britain. The second season is yet to air, and Netflix has yet to greenlight a third. At least one Hollywood veteran was upbeat about their return to Britain. My first thought was smart play, said Spencer Pratt, the reality television star who ran unsuccessfully for Los Angeles mayor this year. Show business in the UK is booming, unlike here. He said his wife, Heidi Montag, a reality television star who was a fan of Meghan's lifestyle show, got all emotional this week at the possibility that Prince Harry might be reconciling with the royal family. In Britain, he said, the couple could take advantage of local tax breaks for film and television production, which are more generous than those in California, and use their own palaces and castles as backdrops. From a business perspective, I think they have more potential to make content for Netflix or Paramount Plus or whoever from England, he added. I would already watch a season of, like, With Love, Meghan and Harry, and Back to the Proud. How this couple's new life in Britain will affect their show business prospects is uncertain. Like many whose Hollywood dreams fall short, Harry and Meghan are moving away from not having ruled out a return. A representative of Harry and Meghan said the couple's businesses are continuing unchanged, and they will still have a toehold in the United States as they are keeping their $14.5 million home in Montecito. For some in a disrupted D.C., Grand Prix is more irritation than celebration. Race preparations have snarled traffic, rerouted flights, and forced the National Gallery of Art to conduct vibration tests. By Karun Demirjian. Downtown traffic has snarled as crews scurry to put up barriers, weld down manhole covers, and even relocate traffic lights. The National Gallery of Art has conducted vibration studies and put up protective panels around some of its outdoor sculptures, while other nearby Smithsonian museums prepared to reduce public access. Airlines have rerouted flights as the closest airport braces for a temporary shutdown, and at least one school within the exclusion zone has had to go fully remote. Even before the first engine has revved in Washington's first Grand Prix this weekend, the effects of turning a warren of museums and historic landmarks at the seat of government into a 1.7-mile IndyCar race course have rippled across the capital, and for some residents and commuters, the resulting disruptions are wearing thin in a summer that has been full of them. It's putting additional stress on a stressful situation, Jason Cummins, who commutes regularly from Baltimore to Washington, said on Friday as he walked near the race perimeter back to his parked car. His drive into the city, normally about an hour, had taken twice as long that morning, he said. I understand that this is the nation's capital, he said, but there's a lot of things that happen here. The Freedom 250 Grand Prix is the final major event in downtown Washington to mark the United States' 250th anniversary, punctuating a summer that also featured a state fair exhibition, an ultimate fighting championship match, and a marathon Independence Day parade, concert, and fireworks display. Many of those events also involve military flyovers, making them sonically inescapable for nearby residents. And all of them have been heavily promoted by President Trump in a city already wary of his attempts to leave his imprint on it. For the race, the Trump administration has planned a two-day extravaganza, complete with more flyovers, fireworks, and an honorary presidential lap of the course. The main event will feature 25 drivers zipping around for 147 laps, crisscrossing the National Mall and making tight turns around some of the nation's most iconic buildings. Race organizers have handed out about 140,000 tickets to spectators, which is also being broadcast on Fox Sports and Sean Duffy, the transportation secretary, has recorded a number of promotional videos to hype the event, repeating what has become its patriotic catchphrase, "Freedom doesn't ring, it revs." While the race is expected to draw crowds, it's also expected to hamper other activities in and around the city, such as the National Book Festival, which is taking place a few blocks north of the race perimeter on Saturday, and travel in and out of Ronald Reagan National Airport, which announced a 3-hour shutdown to coincide with the pre-race festivities on Sunday. Yet organizers, federal officials, and the city's mayor, Muriel Bowser, have said they would be open to the race becoming a tradition. "It's not just fun and games for our city. These are events that draw tens of thousands of people to our city," the mayor's office said in a statement. "Those visitors stay in our hotels, go to our restaurants, they visit our neighborhoods. For D.C., that means more good-paying jobs and more opportunity for our workers and businesses." Representatives of the race organizers did not respond to a request for comment. A day before the race festivities were set to begin, the streets around downtown Washington were eerily quiet, even for a summer Friday. Residents and commuters, it appeared, had heeded city leaders' exhortations to use the metro or simply stay home. But for those whom public transportation was not a viable option, the many street closures, which extended for blocks beyond the racecourse itself, had given the city a labyrinth feel. "I was down there and I thought, I'm never going to get an Uber here," said Rochelle Smith, walking away from the race perimeter to find a ride home to Chevy Chase, a nearby Maryland suburb. "I'm trying to walk to where I can even catch one." "Why are they doing a race downtown? I don't even know," one driver of a blue SUV fumed audibly through rolled-down windows as he pulled up to a stoplight on the edge of the race perimeter and made a sharp right turn to detour. Staging an IndyCar race in a city does not mean just throwing up barricades. City streets must also be turned into flat track. That means manhole covers must be shaved down or built up with special epoxy until they are level with the street and welded shut so they do not turn into inadvertent projectiles as cars pass over them at speeds upwards of 180 miles per hour. More than 200 manhole covers were welded down along the course. Doug Bowles, the IndyCar president, said during an interview on Newsmax this week, in which he also noted that several traffic lights had been removed. A spokesman for the transportation department said that IndyCar was covering the cost of all such preparations and that the Trump administration would work with city leaders to address any post-race impacts to the roads. Washington also presents a denser urban environment than some other host cities for race cars to navigate. The course snakes around buildings in places forcing drivers to make quick successive turns at high speeds and raising the risk of collisions. "It's going to be hard to pass here," Mr. Bowles said in an interview, noting that five of the course's seven turns were at right angles. "Could be a little bit of carnage in this place." But while the promise of collisions may be part of the allure for some racing fans, they have also heightened the concern of critics. For an event of this magnitude in such symbolic, densely packed area in terms of historic sites and rare collections, an undertaking like this should not have been rushed. Mary Okun, assistant director of Living New Deal, a group dedicated to documenting and preserving public works projects from around the time of the Great Depression, said in an interview. Last month, Ms. Okun sent a letter to the National Park Service asking officials to take steps to protect the murals in Wilbur J. Cohen Federal Building, which sits on Independence Avenue along the racecourse, from potential damage. She suggested that the federal government monitor the murals, install temporary sound barriers, and conduct pre- and post-race damage assessments. But the Park Service informed her that vibration monitoring is beyond the role of the NPS for this event, directing her to address concerns to the people responsible for managing the individual structures. Representatives for the Park Service, as well as several museums and government buildings along the route, did not respond to requests for comment. Across the National Mall from the Cohen Building, vibration studies were carried out at the National Gallery of Art, said Chris Abanovas, spokesman for the museum, who added that it had put in place measures to ensure the safety of our staff, visitors, collection, and facilities during the race. While Mr. Abanovas did not specify the measures, plywood structures were seen earlier this week around some of the outdoor sculptures and features, darkening J.M. Pei's glass atrium skylight that erupts into the museum's grounds. With midterms approaching, Trump implores Republicans pretend I'm on the ballot. President Trump was in South Carolina to stump for Darlene Graham, sister of Lindsey, but his own political future was on his mind, too. By Sean McCreesh. Does Donald J. Trump still have the juice? This was one of many open questions in the air Friday night inside the convention center in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, where the president showed up and pleaded with hundreds of Republicans not to forsake him in the coming midterm elections. You're going to lose everything, he warned. At another point, he fretted, I'm going to be impeached. They're going to impeach me. This rhetoric was quite different from the cavalier comments he's been making back in Washington about his political future that have congressional Republicans so freaked out about their own. Comments such as, I don't care about the midterms, and I don't think about Americans' financial situation, and I love the inflation. The immediate reason he was in South Carolina was to boost his anointed Senate candidate, Darlene Graham, sister of Lindsey, whose race for the Republican nomination has gone wobbly more than a month after her brother's death. She's clinging tight to Mr. Trump's Brioni coattails. But is that enough to win these days? Reading from a teleprompter, Mr. Trump recited some nice lines written about Ms. Graham, said a few nice things about her brother, and talked a bit about the political landscape in the state. He brought her up on stage for a moment, and he reminded the crowd that she won the endorsement of Governor Henry McMaster, a Republican who was in the convention center. But mostly Mr. Trump talked about himself and how swimmingly his second term is going. He opened by talking about the ballroom he is building, and the war with Iran is a smashing success, and insisted his economy is as good as it's ever been. Still, he worried aloud that his base would not turn out in November to help protect his Republican majorities in Congress. They say Trump does great when he's on the ballot, but when he's not on the ballot, his people don't come, he said. So what I really want you to do is pretend, please, that I'm on the ballot. Just come and vote. You have to go out and vote in the midterms. At one point, he mentioned that Caroline Leavitt, his outgoing press secretary, was there. The crowd went bananas. He told her to come on up. He needs your help with a Republican Congress for the next 2 years, she said, so get out and vote. Who knows how the Republican Party will fare comes November. Mr. Trump has defied pollsters and conventional wisdom so many times in the 11 years since he rode down the golden escalator that nobody can really predict how he might do. And as he reminded everyone Friday, he is the party. The Republican Party is MAGA, he said. But serious cracks in the MAGA firmament are showing these days. The war with Iran has gone on much longer than Mr. Trump said it would. There's seemingly no end in sight. It's keeping gas prices high and his poll numbers low. An increasing number of high-level defectors with big social media followings have fallen away. A number of his primary endorsements have gone belly up. Should Ms. Graham fail to make it over the line, it will be seen as just the latest indicator of Mr. Trump's mojo slippage. The hundreds of people who waited in line on Friday night in August to hear him speak were about the most Trump-loving crowd imaginable. People wore T-shirts with pictures of his bloodied face and vintage MAGA merch from his early campaigns. And yet, even among this crowd, there was discontent stirring. "He needs to do a better job on the economy this time," said Scott Ganser, three-time Trump-voting Myrtle Beach man who works for Walmart. "The first time he did really good on the economy. I was expecting the same, but I haven't seen the same yet. It wasn't just the gas prices that are up," he said, "all prices. My 401k has gone down instead of going up, and I'm closer to retirement now. As for the war in Iran, I think it was a necessity," he said. There was much support for the war among the crowd, though most people grimaced while discussing it. Nobody seemed to feel that it is going as well as the president says it is. "I think it's very important that we don't have a nuclear weapon, but I think he should have just said from the beginning that it might take a little longer than he thought," said Leslie Simic, a 57-year-old nurse on vacation from New York. Him saying that they'd be in and out in weeks was kind of silly, because you know the press will hold him to it, and now he looks like a J.A., she said, meaning jackass. But she wasn't opposed to the war itself. "I'd pay $10 for a gallon of gas to know that there won't be a nuclear weapon," she added. "I'd just work extra shifts. The problem with society is nobody wants to work anymore." Mr. Trump's second term was, overall, a little rusty, she said. Up by the front row, a 65-year-old retired schoolteacher from North Myrtle Beach named Barbara McDonald watched as a friendly old biker gang took group pictures beneath a massive sign that declared South Carolina as Graham country. Asked about the war with Iran, Miss McDonald replied, "Do you really want me to say what I really think?" "Yes," she was told. "I think that we should have stopped the war and bombed them completely, because I think that they're terrorists and they'll never go away," she said. Graham country, indeed. She reasoned that Mr. Trump must have more information than I do, and there's other allies that we're still trying to appease to make it a more peaceful and hope for a better ending, and he doesn't want to kill people. "Gas prices hurt," she said, "but I'm willing to pay the price. It's hurting us, but it takes a president that's going to have the guts to do that, even though it's hurting him and his political party, because it's the right thing to do," said David LaChance, a 59-year-old retired cop from Myrtle Beach. "I think Trump wanted it over quick, but he's going to do it the right way, and that's what's taking so long. People just got to hang in there, that's all." Mr. Trump kept these people entertained on Friday. He said his wife doesn't exactly love it when he dances to the gay national anthem that he's chosen as his theme song, and they laughed. He pointed the finger at the news media in the room, and they hissed. He reminded people of the time Hillary Clinton said some of his supporters were deplorable, and they booed. Would anybody like to hear the snake, he asked? "Look, it's a Friday night. We have plenty of time, right? What the hell do I have to do? Go back, bomb Iran a little bit more?" He recited the anti-immigration poem he's been telling for years with extra theatrical flair. "I haven't done that in a long time," he said. "There will probably never come a day that Mr. Trump cannot make a convention center full of Republicans laugh, clap, dance, or boo on command. Can he still get them to vote? Good luck, Darlene," he said on the way out, and the village people started blaring. Tropical storm Moke threatens to bring up to a foot of rain to Hawaii. Heavy rain is expected to arrive at the Big Island by Saturday night. The storm comes as Hawaii is still cleaning up from the damage done by Hurricane Leila, by Amy Graff. Tropical Storm Mok will bring a chance of heavy rain and strong winds to Hawaii as it swings by the island chain a couple of hundred miles to the south Saturday night into Monday. The National Hurricane Center said the storm is not expected to grow as large or powerful as Hurricane Leila, which battered the Big Island last weekend. Even though Moke, pronounced Moke, was unlikely to strengthen into a hurricane, meteorologists warned that life-threatening flooding and mudslides were possible, particularly on the island of Hawaii, known as the Big Island. The Big Island could pick up another 5 to 10 inches of rain, with isolated locations receiving up to 15 inches. Eastern Maui was expected to get 3 to 6 inches, and western Maui and the remaining islands, including Oahu, 1 to 2. Blustery conditions were expected on the islands, with wind gusts reaching up to 55 miles per hour, especially at higher elevations. A wind advisory was in effect from noon Saturday to Sunday evening for portions of Maui, Molokai, Lanai, and the Big Island. Large surf and strong rip currents were expected to bring dangerous conditions to portions of the Hawaiian Islands this weekend and into early next week. The alerts come as people clean up from the damage that Leila left with its strong winds and heavy rains that ripped off roofs, flooded roads, and knocked over trees and power lines. There are families and communities across Hawaii Island still without power, water, and basic necessities, said Brianna Kobayashi Kulea, president of the nonprofit Hawaii Rise Foundation. Some roads remain difficult because of downed lines and ongoing recovery work. The National Weather Service issued a flood watch for the Big Island. From late Saturday night through Monday afternoon, alerting the public that overflowing waters from swollen streams could close roads. A watch means that conditions are expected to be favorable for flooding. Forecasters advise people on the island to keep an eye out for more urgent warnings, indicating that flooding was imminent. Key things to know, timing, the closest approach to the Big Island is expected to happen on Sunday. Effects, the worst effects, are expected to be flash flooding and mudslides from heavy rains on the Big Island. Strength, the storm is not only expected to be smaller, more compact and weaker than Leila, but it's also poised to take a track farther to the south. Tropical Storm Mok may never become a hurricane. Moke is the second named tropical storm to form in the central North Pacific this season, with Leila being the first. Back-to-back storms have affected the islands in the past, including Hurricanes Isel and Julia in 2014. And Lester and Madeline in 2016, according to John Bravendier, a meteorologist with the National Weather Service office in Honolulu. This is not an unusual occurrence, he said. While Isel made landfall on the Big Island as a tropical storm, the others passed by the islands. Leila also did not make landfall, which occurs when the storm's eye passes onto land, but the storm's outer edges moved over the Big Island. Wind exceeded 100 miles per hour on the tallest mountain peaks, and over 30 inches of rain fell in the wettest locations. Residents of Hawaii are still recovering from that damage. While local government agencies are establishing distribution centers, Mrs. Koyabashi Kulai said there were still many gaps. Even staff members at the hospital in Kau needed donated supplies because they weren't able to make distribution times at local community centers, according to Elena Kabutu, a spokeswoman for the hospital. She said the donations were such a relief to staff who still have no electricity and started to wash their clothes the old-fashioned way in buckets. By late Saturday morning, Moke was strengthening slightly, spinning over the Pacific Ocean, 425 miles off the coast of Hilo. "I'm hoping the winds won't be as bad, but the rain is always something," said Andrew Chun, a resident of Hilo whose home lost power during last weekend's storm. His wife, Gina Hara Chun, a real estate agent, added that right now the most important thing is taking care of people and their basic needs. The National Hurricane Center said that the center of the storm was expected to pass south of the Big Island on Sunday and then south of the smaller islands into Monday, probably on a track farther south than the one Layla took. But the storm was still expected to get close enough to the Big Island to generate heavy rain. There is still a lot of moisture associated with this storm and in the air, and when you have that much moisture, it brings a threat of flooding, said Liam Tasmus, a meteorologist with the Weather Service in Honolulu. It's been terrible. Thousands in Indiana remain without power. Governor Mike Braun called on the local utility to match the urgency of Gary area residents who have had to endure an outage approaching its second week. By Robert Chirito, Jack Healy, and Amy Graff. It was day 11 without power in Gary, Indiana, and Pierre Irvin was beyond fed up. He could not eat breakfast in his dark, storm-damaged home because he had thrown out all the food rotting in his refrigerator. So he headed to work on Saturday, threading his way past the snapped trees and down power lines, littering the industrial city as frustration grew with the agonizingly slow process of restoring power. "It's been terrible," Mr. Irvin, 46, said. About 30,000 customers across northern Indiana were still without electricity on Saturday evening, nearly 2 weeks after thunderstorms flooded neighborhoods and pummeled the region with hurricane-force winds. About 56% of those people are in Gary, a majority black city of 67,000 that has long grappled with poverty, population loss, and disinvestment as its steel industry shrank and homes and buildings were abandoned. "Most people are being overlooked," said Miles Tolliver, a Gary councilman whose family has been staying outside Chicago while they wait for power to be restored. "Our families are sitting in the dark. We don't need any more excuses. We need the lights on." On Saturday, as power returned to some customers across northern Indiana, Gary residents said they were angry and despondent to find themselves once again at the back of the line. The local utility, the Northern Indiana Public Service Company, said that Gary and the nearby city of Portage would be the last to have their electricity back, potentially by the end of Tuesday. As they sat inside their dark living rooms or on porches to escape the stagnant air inside, some residents said they doubted a rich white town would have been left to languish for so long without power. "I don't understand it," said Damon Willis, 45, a chef at a casino restaurant who's been without power since August 11th. "It shouldn't be this long. I think if we weren't a black city, things would be different." On Saturday, some residents said a few businesses and apartments had gotten their power back and more utility trucks were rolling through the streets. Steve Segura, a city spokesman, said the utility was sending an additional 85 line workers and 240 vegetation management crews. But residents and politicians were increasingly exasperated. Governor Mike Braun of Indiana urged the utility to match the urgency of the people who had languished without power for nearly 2 weeks. Mr. Braun said on Friday that he requested an expedited major disaster declaration from the Federal Emergency Management Agency to bring in more resources. "Bring in more crews," Mr. Braun, a Republican, told the utility in a pointed social media post on Saturday. "Put every available resource into the field. Get creative. Get the job done." Northern Indiana Public Service Company said its electric system had suffered unprecedented and widespread damage from the storm and did not answer its 24-hour hotline for media inquiries on Saturday. An automated message said the voicemail box was full. On August 11th, Gary was pummeled by a derecho, a group of intense thunderstorms that last several hours, which brought heavy rain and damaging wind gusts of 99 miles per hour as part of a punishing parade of storms through Indiana since the start of spring. Through July, 89 tornadoes have touched down in the state this year, well above the annual average of 28, according to the National Weather Service. "This has been a hyperactive season for us," said Ricky Castro, a meteorologist with the Weather Service office in Romeoville, Illinois, southwest of Chicago. And that's all the time we have for today. Stay safe, and thank you for listening.